Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you for joining me here again today. This is episode number 415, and in a few moments, I'll be sharing with you a conversation I had with Tula Saratsis. Tula is a certified end-of-life doula who specializes in perinatal and pediatric palliative care, end-of-life and after-death care support. And we have just a beautiful, very touching discussion together. Tula is just an amazing person, and you'll see that as you listen to our conversation. But I think that you'll really take away a lot from this interview, so stay tuned for that. Before we get there, I have a couple of announcements. One is, as I've mentioned this off and on during this year, that this year, 2023, is the 10-year anniversary of End of Life University. I've been doing interviews for 10 years. And as part of my celebration of that 10th anniversary, I've created a special mug, a 10th anniversary mug for End of Life University podcast. You'll find that on the show notes page with the link you can just click if you're interested in buying one. And I'm also starting a campaign called $10 for 10 years, which means $1 for each of the 10 years this End of Life University has been around. And I'm asking people who've been enjoying this podcast, whether you're enjoying it just now for a few months or if you've been listening for years, maybe you've never considered making a donation, but I'm creating a special campaign where I'm just asking each person, if you do benefit from listening, if you could kick in just $10. I'm trying to fund a new laptop, which I desperately need because mine is quite old and it won't support some of the software that I need to do better editing for the podcast. And I also need a new microphone to go with the new laptop. So I'm trying to gradually raise the money for that equipment, which will help me stay up to date with this podcast. So again, on the show notes at eolupodcast.com, you'll find a button for that says $10 for 10 years. That's just a one-time $10 donation. And there's also another button that just says support this podcast, and that will tell you three different ways you can make a contribution. Otherwise, if you want to choose your own amount, you can make a PayPal donation for any amount. You can also buy me a coffee, or you can join my Patreon page at patreon.com/EOLU. And in advance, I really appreciate your support. I want to thank my latest supporter, Natalie, for joining the team on Patreon, and Kim Adams for increasing your pledge on Patreon. I really appreciate that. Also, Kathleen Valley-Stein for buying me 10 coffees. Thank you, Kathleen. You're keeping me going in coffee, which I need every day. Then I really appreciate that. And then also Kristen Cannell, thank you for making a PayPal donation. So in advance, I'll thank you for your support, and thanks for all of you who've already stepped up in the past and those of you who may step up and join my 10 for 10 campaign. I really appreciate that. One final announcement, which I've made before on behalf of Anuma, a health startup that has created a virtual reality program called Clear Light. And it's designed for individuals working with a life-threatening disease diagnosis. They're offering exclusive sessions free of charge as part of a trial supported by researchers at Imperial College London. And if you'd like more details or wish to indicate interest in participating, you can go to anuma.com/trial. And I will say it's an amazing experience. I had the chance to participate in it last fall, and for me, it was life-changing. And I have left a link to a blog I wrote about that experience and also the link to anuma.com/trial. You'll find all of this in the show notes if you go to eolupodcast.com www.thebetterhumanpodcast.com. And you can look for this episode number 415. You'll find the links down below if you scroll down to links mentioned in this episode, and it's all there for you. So now we'll move on with my interview with Tula Siratsis. And as always, I'll be back afterwards for a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm very happy to welcome my special guest, Tula Siratsis. Tula is a certified end-of-life doula who specializes in perinatal and pediatric palliative care, end-of-life, and after-death care support. She was called to this work in 2016 after her daughter Angelica's anticipated passing from a life-limiting condition at nearly 7 years old. The mission of her service is to impact cultural change and raise awareness of connection, understanding, and options for children and their circles of care. Her outreach to others is rooted in advocacy that parallels activism through community death care education. And Tula, I'm so happy to welcome you, and I want to thank you so much for joining me here.
Thank you for inviting me into your space for conversation.
When I heard about your work, I was just so very interested to talk with you because I honestly don't very often meet people who choose to work in pediatric palliative care and end-of-life care because most of us find it so challenging and so difficult. But I thought it might be nice if you could share a little bit more about your story with your daughter, Angelica, and how you felt called to do the work that we're doing.
Of course. When my Angelica was born, she was born naturally and normally. There were no problems, no indications that there would be any difficulties, any medical issues. And at 3 days old, she was home and started to present with what we now know as symptoms of high ammonia levels. It was a very silent and shocking ambulance ride to the emergency room. And I felt that was self-preservation for me. I was taking in through the shock of what was unfolding, that my child was starting to become unresponsive. And as soon as we reached the ED, it was very apparent that this was going to be a different kind of journey for me as a parent. And in her wisdom, the attending physician looked right at me and said, "Your baby is very sick." And that's all I needed to know in that moment. There were, I'm sure, many other things that she could have told us at that time, but that's all I could process. And I knew in my spirit that it was possible that my baby could die at that time. And, yeah, it was very intense. And it was interesting, too, because there was this sense of a knowing that I had some control. And that was my spiritual upbringing. And knowing that I could pray for her outside of the room. We were asked to leave for some procedures, and watching through the window, I knew that that's all I could do at that time, and that was very important for her and for us as a family. Shortly after that, she was admitted to the NICU and was too sick to be in the NICU and was admitted to the pediatric ICU for hemodialysis. Before she was placed with a line, I requested that our parish priest come to the ward and baptize her, and she did have a clinical baptism. And that gave me so much comfort. And in that moment, it was so beautiful and sacred to know that I could provide something for my child. I also had an icon of the Virgin Mary in my purse, and I had requested to place that in her isolette. And it was very much, again, a comfort knowing that I could bring something to the table with all of this medical happening around me and not knowing exactly. It was entry into this world. And after that, it was just a beautiful unfolding of family, community, and just hoping for the best. And she did survive that. And that within that year, she did have a massive metabolic stroke that decimated her basal ganglia, and that affects the movement center. And she had chorea movements, and she had started crawling and lost the ability to crawl and sit up. And so, again, taking care of this medically fragile child and learning how to be a parent at the same time and knowing that there was potential for death, that was a lot to take in. But somehow, just keeping in mind that I did have a sense of control and choice to take care of her was very helpful. And that just was a natural instinct as a parent. And being introduced into the medical community was a different challenge, because I was nurturing my child in collaboration with many other people. We were followed by many other clinics. She had quite a bit of testing that needed to be done, and medications and physical therapy. Everything was coming together, and it was a lot to sort out. But again, coming back to the fact that I'm a parent, I had the ability to control what I could do for her, and that was love. And I remember going to our priest for a family meeting after her stroke, and just asking for some spiritual guidance. And he said, the best thing that you can do, the best medicine you can give her is love. And I knew I could do that. And that was our baseline, loving her and caring for her and giving her a voice as well.
And so for all of the nearly 7 years of her life, you had this uncertainty surrounding you, I guess, knowing that she would die from this illness, but not knowing when, and just being in this state of constantly providing the loving care that you were giving to her, kind of not knowing what was going to happen next.
Right, right. And that was interesting, because she needed to be an independent person too. And knowing how to prepare her to be in her own community and to go to school, that was really important. Now, fast forward in the work that I do, I understand that there's so much more support that could have been given and so much more information that I could have had more confidence to exercise. But sorting my way through this experience was challenging and it could be daunting at times. In fact, there were times where she would have crises and spiral and I felt unprepared, and that was a very difficult place to be in.
When did you get the inspiration to become an end-of-life doula yourself, working with children?
When I was taking care of Angelica through her dying process, it felt so natural and loving, and having been in the hospital and in the medical campus and community for so many years, and being able to witness other family stories unfold, I knew that this was a very beautiful and unique position to be in. And being an educator myself and knowing that there was an opportunity to teach, I kept that in my heart. Taking care of her. And additionally with that was the guidance of our home funeral guide and the funeral director that collaborated with us in the state of Michigan. We do require a funeral director to be involved in transport and paperwork, but we could still have, it's legal in all states to have the body at home. And through that process, I started to feel like this could be an option for other families. And this is something that I felt very called to do, even on her deathbed. It was very interesting. I understood what that was going to mean.
So it feels as if you had this curriculum laid out for you for almost 7 years, where you were learning all the things that you would need to know to help other people and to share other people. And as if the calling came early on and you were preparing for it all that time.
Exactly. And, it's interesting because Angelica's my teacher, and all of the medical community and the other families that I connected with, and taking in that information and being able to repurpose that has helped me with meaning making and surviving as a bereaved parent.
And it's an incredible legacy for Angelica as well, because her life and her dying process have been helpful to so many other families and children through what you learned and what she was able to teach you.
The idea of being able to empower others to help them come into their own power, to claim their voice, to tell their story, to control their narrative, is an outreach that's natural to my calling as a teacher as well. But there is something so special of that preparation that I can't describe, that I didn't realize until I started getting into this work, that those were the talents that were being uncovered through working with other families.
It's so very special because even like in my work in hospice, I very rarely found people who were comfortable working with children in hospice and palliative care. And we had nurses who simply said, I can't do it. I can't take any pediatric cases because it was just so triggering and painful for them. And so that's why I feel like your services are so valuable, because you're able to be present and you're able to be there in such a beautiful and loving way, having experienced it yourself. And I think for others of us who haven't experienced the death of a child, our imaginations make us terrified of being around someone who's going through that. And yet you have courage and comfort to be there.
Thank you. That's an excellent point. Because it was normal for us. And that daily flirtation with the death was ever present, and creating ritual around it, and knowing that leaving my daughter to go to work was potentially the last time that I'd see her, changed me as a person. And people that haven't had that experience, of course, don't understand that. And part of this work is to educate others and to help them to normalize what others need, what families need, what children need. And that is part of the process of cultural change. Going into pediatrics, it's a guarded practice. We're not very welcome right away as outside consultants. We bring something very different to the table. And part of that work is to help staff, to help others feel comfortable, and to teach that they do have the ability and the capability to help others, even through their discomforts, turning towards that suffering. And knowing that just holding space and being present, bearing witness to what's unfolding, to what's happening, is very powerful and very helpful. I really think, Dr. Wyatt, that folks feel that they can't do anything, or that they feel powerless in that very, very delicate, complicated, and very heavy situation. But they do have those abilities, and I've seen it. And that's part of the, as I mentioned, that's part of the work that I do, being in the room and guiding and coaching the folks that are also helping the families. It is the networking and the idea of community death care, part of the teaching practice.
And I love that you mentioned earlier the power of love, the love that you had for Angelica, and how important it was to actually know to be with her with love is doing something. And I think that it's doing something important and totally valuable to be able to be present with love. And that's such a good reminder for all of us, because sometimes we're in situations like this where we don't feel like there isn't anything very tangible that we can do that could make a difference. But to be present and to hold love in our hearts, you know, and to create this a loving space for families and for their child is huge. That's a huge thing to do for someone.
And what comes to mind for me is the idea of fear. And that's important for us to confront. And one of the powerful exercises that we can complete as end-of-life practitioners or people helping others is to think about death in a way that resonates with our personal practice, and to be comfortable with that, and knowing that we're in a position to reframe that heavy experience, that heavy and sad experience for others.
That's really beautiful. And I think you're right, thinking about death and applying it to every situation that we're in, that everyone of any age, everyone that we know and love, everyone that we see around us is also mortal as we are. And so death doesn't discriminate. Death can come for anyone at any age. And we have to remind ourselves of that sometimes, because we get comfortable talking about death at an older age, death for people of advanced age and natural dying for people who are elderly. And we find some comfort in that. But we have to go to the places where we're uncomfortable, which is really looking at the reality of that children do develop life-limiting illnesses at times, and children do die, as heartbreaking as it is.
The idea of knowing that these traumatic situations happen is the first step. And part of that process of being present for the families in this work, and in my experience and from what I've witnessed, is knowing that these are people's children, and we need to really confront, as we mentioned earlier, the idea that the death is imminent or that the death has happened. And part of that comfort that families feel is having choice and having voice. And the idea of the life-limiting illnesses brings a different aspect to it, especially for children that understand that they're dying. And this adds an element of honoring their voice too, and connecting the needs of the children and the caregivers. And that's another layer, another complex layer. And again, it goes back to that education and awareness and understanding of what needs to be done.
Yes. It's bringing to my mind a hospice case we worked with of a 5-year-old with a terminal cancer, who himself said he wanted to discontinue treatment because he was tired of it. And already the doctors had told the parents the treatments would not save his life. Mm-hmm. And yet when the parents advocated for their child who didn't want any more treatment, the medical providers were so upset about it, and they were threatening to take custody away from the parents if they refused to get more treatment. And it was such a gap in understanding or sensitivity toward the case, that the medical providers were so fixated on treatment that they couldn't see what was really happening, and that the child was actually the one carrying enough wisdom to say, I understand, you know, I understand what's happening and what kind of trajectory I'm on, and I just don't want to suffer the treatments any longer. And so that's something I'm curious about, dealing with the medical system and how that has been for you when difficult decisions have to be made.
The most important part of the dialogue is seeking understanding from all sides in bridging the ideas and concepts, the medical concepts, the medical community, with the feelings of the child, the family, and what is going to be the best outcome for the child. And that's where ethics gets messy. And sometimes we don't acknowledge that in the medical community, folks feel that the death is a failure. And that is a problem, because death is not always a failure. Grief is not a failure. The idea of confronting grief as a medical professional is a whole separate idea, a whole separate story. It is looking at the system in a different way. And the absence of collaboration, the system collapse. And that includes all members involved in the moving parts of what is happening. The decisions that need to be made really have to start again with that idea of understanding and a holistic approach. And the most important part of that in community death care is cultural competency. And that's where the most distress happens. And that's where I witness the most distress and social injustice, all of it, when folks are unable to, for whatever reason, even if they're very competent professionally, unable to see or connect with the big picture.
And as you wrote in your bio, we need community education around death and death care and how to be with dying. And it's so, we need it desperately, really, in all sectors of our society.
Yeah, especially with children. And I'd like to take a moment to recognize the perinatal aspect of this work and how that is very, very much an underserved population of people needing options and choices and understanding of what they can do, especially when it comes to caring to term and having a home funeral.
Yes, I agree with you. I think that's a very underserved population. And if anything, we've just really hidden that aspect of the tragedy that can come in a perinatal situation. We've kind of hidden that from our view. And so many families have been underserved and have not received the help they need at that time when they're dealing with that situation.
And that's where we can focus our energy in the system, is changing that conversation. People are not willing to talk about babies dying, and that is part of the tragedy that can affect the path of a grieving family forever. And I know it sounds pretty somber and it sounds very heavy, but it can alter the experience when we understand that this is somebody that needs normalizing and validating of what they're going through. And again, those options and choices for voice and choice.
That's so true. I wanted to ask you about talking about death with children, and particularly a child who has a life-limiting diagnosis, and if you have any suggestions for that. And I don't know if you had conversations with Angelica, and any tips that you might have for people who need to be having these conversations.
With Angelica, I sensed she was primarily nonverbal, but we had strong communication. She understood because of her metabolic stroke, it affected her ability to speak, but she was cognitively aware, and I was able to nurture her and raise her with the idea that that she would be taken care of and that she would still have control. And in those conversations, I let her lead me. And so there were times where I'd bring it up, especially towards the end. And she'd look at me like, "Mom, I'm watching my show. I'm playing with my dolls. Leave me alone." And so and understanding that you know, to follow what the child needs and to follow what my child needed was very important. And everyone is different. Every situation is different. And it really is approaching the child with the language that they're familiar with, the cultural experience that they have, however they connect with their families, whether they're biological, blended, or chosen. And having those conversations with folks and making it more open. Because once the permission is there to have the conversation with the child and the family and the community, there is going to be more dialogue and more of an understanding of how to approach the child. Again, even nonverbal, different cognitive abilities, we can definitely be more open, and it's a part of that normalizing, validating their experiences and understanding that it's going to be uncomfortable, but they'll lead us into that.
It seems like that's a huge service that you could offer to families, is just helping them understand how to have these conversations, even how to talk to one another and how to face what's coming and to be more open about what's actually happening.
In that dialogue, I don't do very much talking. I do a lot of listening, and that deep listening is what people primarily need, and they'll figure it out. There are guided questions. There are There's feedback that I might give, and that's really helpful to the families. Again, it's that the idea of giving permission to also acknowledge that there may be a need to stop talking about it. I served a family where a child was born with a very rare genetic condition, life-limiting condition, and they had a very many difficulties from the onset, and it was a surprise for them as well, and many decisions to make and not sure how to approach it. They knew that they wanted a home funeral for their child, and that's how we were connected, and I sensed that they needed more privacy as a family, that they had what it was to take care of their child, to advocate in the medical system. And so I was hovering in the background, so to speak. And when it was time to talk about it, I received a phone call, and I went over to the home, and the conversation really started by just getting to know the family in their own space, and not going right for, well, what do you want to do? What are you thinking? And it was just talking about being a family and taking care of their child, and just the beautiful room that they had for the child, and the medical setup was just so wonderfully laid out and natural, and it was part of the environment, and just taking care of your child with all of these extra medical things happening. And I sat on the floor, talked with mom, and dad had left for a while, and mom started to talk about her experience with death and how difficult it was to connect with the idea of her baby dying. And then we started talking about home funeral just a little bit. I had asked a couple of questions and then sensed that it was time to stop. And that's part of this work, is that we don't have a list. We just go with what the family needs, and it's intuition. And it was just such a lovely visit. When we were finished with the visit, the most important thing that happened is that there was trust building there, and the connection was made. And when it was time for my services, then they knew who I was, and they knew I was there to help and not to be intrusive. And so that's the lovely part of the work as a doula, as a home funeral guide, that we are able to connect with our intuition and our instinct, and we don't have a list that we have to complete and charts that we have to fill. And that's important documentation. We do document our visits and keep track of what needs to be done. And sometimes we are asked to share that information with the permission of the family. And that's part of that collaboration piece. But those intimate conversations, it's more on a friendship level and understanding that this is natural. And so fast forward, when the baby died and I was called in to the hospital, it just was so beautiful. And I know it's difficult for people to hear that when you experience it, and having to witness a beautiful death in a baby is something that needs to be witnessed in order to understand. And so going back to that conversation and that trust building, and it really speaks to listening, again, that deep listening, and knowing when to back away and not to be intrusive. And everything worked out. We are very much, I believe, in the palliative care and death care continuums, focused on outcomes, and we're focused on getting things right. And that's not always going to happen, and that's okay. It's the human part of it, or having a plan. And plans are great, and having an idea, and plans can change. And that's the major part of my work as a practitioner, is understanding and accommodating the fluidity of situations. People change their minds, and that's okay. And even at the deathbed of this child, I asked, would you like to have the funeral director take the baby to the funeral home, or would you like your baby at home? Even though they wanted to have the home funeral, those questions are important, especially through that shock and trauma of the gentle guidance. Is this something you still want to do? Is this something that you're able to do? And it's okay if you're unable to.
I really like that emphasis on the fluidity of the situation, and that just being able to be intuitive and recognize in each moment what is needed, instead of having a plan in our heads that we're trying to follow, which may no longer fit and may not be the right thing at that particular time.
Again, plans are important. It calls to mind a family I served. They carried to term. The baby was diagnosed with a fatal condition at 20 weeks scan, and the family really wanted to create memories. They accepted what was happening, and it was more about validating that it is okay to change your mind. They had thought about a home funeral, and one of the conversations I had with Mom, I met with her one time weekly on the phone until she delivered, was that she wanted to have a plan ready, but she also wanted to have the flexibility of knowing that if something different happened in the outcome of the birth, that they would be able to follow through in a different path. And that ended up happening. And Dr. Wyatt, one of the things I wanted to emphasize too is that I wasn't present at the birth. All of my work in that case was about being a support and being a loving presence throughout the whole experience, and being a sounding board, because it could be a very isolating experience to carry a baby to term, knowing that the baby can be still born. The baby did end up living for a couple hours, and the family shared with me how beautiful that experience was, and the preparation beforehand was helpful. We talked about a family picture and having something to wear and having something for the baby to wear and just the idea, who would you like to have in the room and all of that. And again, it is that the idea of community death care is that I wasn't needed at the birth and deathbed, but I was there to help in the way that I could that the family needed.
Yeah, and just to help them prepare to the best of their ability for the situation they might be in. And you've mentioned home funerals, and I believe you said you had a home funeral for Angelica, and I wanted to talk more about that and what the importance, the benefits of having a home funeral, and what that might look like as well.
Yeah, so I took care of Angelica 24/7 complex medical care. We did have a little bit of help. And of course, in hospital stays, there was a lot more help. But I knew my child, and I took care of her medically for her life. And the idea of handing her body over to someone else did not resonate with me. I'm of Greek heritage, and being in Greece, the bodies stay at home generally. There is no embalming, and it is part of the community experience for people to come over to help. There's usually someone that helps prepare the body, or there is an area, we call it an office, if you will, where people are sent, bodies are sent to be prepared and then sent back home. So it's a different experience, and I knew I wanted that for my child and for myself. And in fact, I did talk to Angelica about it, and I promised her that she would stay Spiti, which means home. She would be at Spiti until the end, until we took her to church, and that was important for her. And part of that process of knowing that I would be able to take care of my child after the last breath helped me to take in the reality of the loss. My hands were always busy. I was preparing medications, taking care of the feeding pump, taking care of her button. There was always something happening. And to think about her leaving the home and not having anything to do was also very difficult for me to connect with, and that wasn't going to happen. I did know that home funeral was possible, and even before Angelica was in hospice, and that was part of the difficulty of that preparation for myself, for my family, is not knowing how to bring that up with the care teams and with her primary care, the genetics team, who they were wonderful and they were like family to us. But they didn't talk about death, and it wasn't something that we discussed in the clinic or discussed during hospitalizations. There was some idea that they understood that what we knew was going to happen, but again, there were no clear conversations, and that caused a lot of distress for me, especially in her last ICU stay, which was horrific. It was harrowing. It was over a month. She had coded. She had let us know that she wanted to keep going. So we continued with treatments and anything, any life saving measures at that time. But in the back of my mind, I always thought, well, what if she died now and I want to take her home? What do I do? And that was, again, part of that idea of what do I do as a parent, having choice and voice. What I encountered was a newspaper article in a local paper on a home funeral, and I clipped it and noted that, and knew that I was going to call this person. I visited the website and I was prepared. But again, I didn't know the logistics, the legalities, what was going to happen. But it was, again, there were so many other things happening and unfolding and decisions to be made. And this wasn't a very welcome decision, welcome topic that, I just held on to that. So going into hospice, it was freer, and the conversations were more flowing and the dialogue was open. And we had a phenomenal social worker and nurse in hospice care that had experience with home funerals. They knew, they reassured me that the person that I had, connection with, was going to help out. And so, that helped me to relax a lot more and to really help Angelica through that process. She chose what she was going to wear. She knew, she approved, and that was important. I asked her, what do you want in the casket? And she looked around her room and I said, well, you can't take everything. So, with the special things that you don't want anybody else to have. And she chose. And so we had that ready. And while her system was failing, and most children, they are pretty alert until the end. She was quite alert. And once her body started giving up, it was very clear that it was almost time, and having those preparations at hand was so helpful. There was a sheet that my grandmother made for my dowry. She had sewed it. There's a knit paneling in it, and it was supposed to go to my firstborn daughter, if I had one. And I promised Angelica I would give that to her. And while she was dying, Dr. Wyatt, I was ironing the sheet and to letting her know that we were ready and that we were going to take care of her. Again, those memories are so precious. And that's what the home funeral brought for us, is reframing the experience. There was not as much fear as preparation and anticipation of something to happen that was life changing, but also an important work. For me as a parent, and to help my child cross over without that fear. And when she did take her last breath, we were cheering her on. She was very relaxed. It was her control. She was letting us know when it was time. And so she reposed with a smile, and I knew that was a victory for all of us, that was going to happen. And again, we were able to take care of her right in her bed, wash her and dress her. And we used dry ice, for preservation. And that, again, that was part of the preparation for the whole funeral guide. And we were connected with the local funeral home, to help take care of the body. And so, you know, overcoming that fear, just knowing we just wanted to take care of her, and it was happening and it was just natural. And I knew what to do. I didn't feel like I needed to read through a list. I just took care of my child. And that was important. And we had our prayer service here in the Orthodox faith. We have something called a Trisayon. It's basically the first declaration to the community that this person is dead and that we are praying for their soul. And I was standing in my living room, full of people. We had so many folks show up. It was in the middle of the summer and very, very difficult to have all of our communities join us because people were on vacation. It was short notice. I looked out the window and there were people in the yard. We had opened up the window. We had two priests and the prayers started. And I just felt this amazing, uplifting spirit of community and love. And I knew that my child would be so happy for that. And again, that's what a home funeral brought for us.
Mm. Well, thank you for sharing that story. It's so touching. And I will never forget the image that you described of ironing the sheets for your daughter. That's just so precious. And it really does mark that even though we have anticipatory grieving before a loved one dies, but when we can just be present for every moment of whatever is happening, it can help us with the overall grief process, it seems, because we continue to love, we continue to hold our loved one in that space while they're alive and then even after death, and we continue pouring out that love. And the home funeral, it seems, is another manifestation of just all the love that has surrounded this child.
And that's what I witness with people that are in a position to be able to do that for their own children. It is being able to be in their own space and to allow ritual to unfold organically. And that's how it was for my Angelica. And when I hear stories of the home funeral successes and the beautiful memories, it really fuels that passion and that awareness that we need to increase education around this area. And that's why I do what I do. It's not for everyone, but just to know that option exists is so important for us as a society and a culture, and with children and being able to connect with that. And even in traumatic situations, it's possible. The child has an autopsy, has had quite a bit of compromise compromised body, and the integrity of the body, it needs cosmetic assistance. That is also possible for home funeral organ donation. Again, knowing that choice is available.
And I don't know if home funeral is something that could be done at the last moment if someone didn't know about it before, but at the time of death hears about it, or is it still possible to make that happen? Because it seems like it benefits from planning in advance and knowing that's coming, but I just wondered how spontaneous it can be.
Of course, pre-planning is ideal, but that's not always possible. And of course, anything we can do in our power as home funeral guides, as death doulas, any type of end of life practitioner who is helping a family will help. We'll do that. There was my first case that calls to mind that the same exact experience that the staff did not know that the mom wanted to take the baby home, and mom was very adamant. I'm not leaving without my child. I received the phone call, and a baby had rigor and had been dead for at least 5 hours. Ideally, we would be preserving the body. The body would be in a position for transport by then, but that didn't happen, and that's okay. And we had such an instant collaboration. Everyone wanted to help mom. in this desire to take her child home. And in my assessment, I could tell right away that mom just wanted more time with the baby and needed to have privacy. And so the service that I provided at that point was to make sure mom was taken care of, that she was okay, that she had nourishment, and that she was still pumping and needed support with the breast milk. And that was part of my assessment, as well as knowing that we weren't going to be able to cool the body right away. And that's okay. I just had mom take a look at the body with me, and she knew that she could bathe the body at home. She didn't need to do that at the hospital. And we talked about that it may be where the funeral director will need to do some cosmetic assistance. So those conversations happened. It was gentle guidance, but again, knowing when to stop talking and to allow that grief to settle in and the process to happen of bonding after death, which it seems difficult to digest, but it's very important for people that want to experience that. And we made it happen. And the funeral director, we finally had a funeral home that they did the first one that was called by the social worker. They didn't know the protocols and what to do, and that's okay. Was confused and didn't understand. And so that delayed the process of discharge and transport to the home. By the time we were able to contact the second funeral home and have everything ready and in place, there was advocacy that needed to be done. And so the funeral director was concerned, wanted to take the baby to the funeral home for cosmetic assistance. And we did talk about that mom is prepared. There was some purging at that point. And mom was just lovingly taking care of all of that without even being distressed. It would be more distressful to take the baby away. And so we made it happen. And again, it's that power of love that we were talking about. And the funeral director felt it and knew what needed to happen. And it was okay. And they ended up having a 4-day vigil. And it was beautiful. It was all mom, all community got it together. And they were able to travel with the body to the crematory and witness that.
Wow. Wow, that's so beautiful. What an incredible service you have provided to families to just help them in the moment when there really are not very many people around them who have answers to these questions or could help them, and that you're there with the expertise and the wisdom to just, and the gentle guidance that they might need. What a gift and a blessing that is.
Thank you, Dr. White. And I wanted to mention that the staff was distressed as well. The staff taking care of children, especially that are frequently in the hospital, do have attachments to the child and to the family. And in the medical community, that vulnerability is discouraged. It's more cultural, and there's no judgment there. And in some cases, it's for boundaries, professional boundaries. And I sensed that in the folks taking care of the family, that they were also distressed by the death itself. And so I was able to step in and help with that. And I mentioned before, it's coming in and helping those bearing witness as well. And part of the work is understanding that the medicalized rituals are important to staff. And when it changes, when the plan alters, when the protocols change, that they can also be very distressing. Because the expectation is that the family spends time with the body, the family leaves, the body is washed, placed in the bag, ID'd, and then transported to the morgue. So, and that routine is very comforting in a way, because that's what you do. And so when there's an altered approach to that, and especially if there's no frame of reference, then the part of our work as death doulas and home funeral guides is to provide education on the spot as well.
Mm. Wow, that's so perceptive of you to recognize the fact that there's comfort in the medical rituals as well, and the grief that staff members feel when a patient they've connected with dies. And it's really not normalized in the medical system to acknowledge, for medical providers to acknowledge grief, to even talk about it or to even be vulnerable enough to let others know that they're grieving. And that for me is such a huge tragedy because it's the most natural thing in the world. Of course.
Vulnerability is not weakness. And we confuse that quite a bit. I will say that when I first started working as a doula, I did not want to show any vulnerability. And when I realized that that was damaging to me as a practitioner and as a human being, vulnerability is what helps us to connect with others, especially in that heart space. When we had Angelica's home funeral, the head of the division for genetics, who had taken care of Angelica since infancy, was such an advocate for us, consummate professional. We really had a difficult time processing the death. The team had visited her when she was in hospice before she was actively dying. And just spent some time with her in her room. It was quite amazing to witness that interaction. That she was so excited to see her people in her home. And so fast forward to the home funeral, there was this feeling of failure. And he said, Tulu, we did everything that we could. And he said, I know we did. We all did everything that we could, but it was her time. And her system was not open to any more interventions. It wouldn't be fair to her. And again, it speaks to the idea of acknowledging and turning towards the personal grief as a practitioner. And I do that myself as well. It's not that I don't feel for the children dying in the moment. I'm in a different mode. And making sure that I am assessing and taking care of and observing and doing what I can to complete the work in a way that is going to be successful for the family and for everyone involved. But in that downtime and in that reflection, I do break down sometimes. And I used to think that was not professional and not in front of others, but on my own time. But I needed that because taking care of my Angelica helped me to connect with a side of humanity that I wouldn't have before. And there's this beautiful unconditional love that's associated with that experience. And part of my self-care, not only is being strong in my own faith and my faith practice, but allowing myself to feel the emotions that I need to and validating what I need to go through and process after working with families.
Even as we're observing and talking about the beauty that comes with death and the love that surrounds it, it's also very painful, and we can't ignore the pain either, because we feel the pain when we're participating in the process, and it's the pain of life in a way. Really, it's the pain that comes with being alive, and so it's important that we do have self-care practices where we can acknowledge our own pain and we can tend to that and look after our own hearts.
Again, grief is not failure. It's a human experience.
Exactly. And it's one of the most common human experiences. We're all born, we're all die, we will all die, and we all grieve at some time or another in life. And so it's really what ties us together in a way with all other living beings. I have a concern, as I said at the very beginning, that a lot of people shy away from pediatric palliative care and pediatric and perinatal end-of-life care. And I don't know if you have any advice you would give or tips you would give to people who just feel afraid of it, to encourage more people to... There might be people feeling called to it, but who still have fear and stay away from it. And anything you could say to them?
Of course, there is a hesitance. And I have doulas that contact me that I mentor, that I've mentored, that are interested in this path, in the pediatric path. And they say, well, I don't have very much experience. I know I'm feeling like I want to do this, but I personally haven't lost a child, or I don't know what it will be like in the moment. And, you know, we sit with that. And it is the first step. When you are called to the work, everything else will follow. And part of this path of helping others, especially in a situation where it is unique and complicated, different than adult care, when you're in it and you're in it to take care of others and to support others, you'll find that strength. And the relief and the connection that people have when you can see them for who they are and what they need and actually listen will help guide those next steps professionally. And that fear will start to lift. It's natural to be afraid to go into a practice where we feel that it is unnatural for children to die, for babies to die. When we are bearing witness and bringing our expertise to the table, then it changes the whole experience. And that is what I could offer as a experienced end-of-life practitioner.
That's really beautiful. I just want to thank you so much, Tula, for this work you're doing that's so very special, and your willingness to join me here and just and talk about it and share so openly and so beautifully about your own life experiences and the patients that you've worked with. And I'm really grateful to you for being here with me.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Wyatt, for providing this opportunity to have this dialogue.
You're so welcome. And I wanted to ask if anyone wanted to connect with you, the best way to do that. And I know we talked before about possibly through social media.
Correct. So I am reachable best by email. And that is tulasaratsis@gmail.com. I also have a Facebook page that is open to the public. I provide quite a few resources. You can also follow my own experience as a bereaved parent and navigating this work and in my grief. And I do have Instagram handle @Tula_Saratsis.
All right. And I can leave links to those on the show notes for this episode if people want to connect with you. And lovely. I just want to say just thank you once again and blessings to you.
It's an honor, Dr. Wyatt. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Tula Saratsis. I'm just so impressed with her work and so touched by how difficult this work is, but how much grace she brings to it and her beautiful compassion and light as she helps families through these very, very difficult times of perinatal loss or the death of a child. And when Tula talked about helping families with home funerals, that really means so much to me because I can imagine how beneficial it is for families to be guided through that process, to be able to have a home funeral for a pregnancy loss or for the death of a child, and to know that there's a guide like Tula there who can help people means so much because I think many families would not be able to participate in that ritual without help. So perhaps some of you listening feel called in the same way Tula was to do this work, and I hope you are inspired by our conversation. So if you enjoy this content, please be sure to tell other people about it. Share the podcast with them so that they can take part in this information as well. Remember that I have a YouTube channel also for anyone who likes watching videos, and you can see the videos of every interview there. Also, I have another podcast called What Really Matters, Everyday Spirituality, which is just me talking about the whole path of trying to grow spiritually as we live these challenging lives. So you can search for that podcast if you like that as well. And don't forget, you can go to eoluniversity.com/support if you'd like to make a financial contribution to keep this show on the air. I really appreciate it for anyone who makes that choice. I'll be back next week with another interview. And until then, remember, we're here for love. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings you next, and love each and every moment of your very precious existence. Bye-bye.